Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, on this Tuesday, November 21st, and today I am pleased to introduce Tori Sindoff, who will be my co-host for the day. Tori is a science communications intern at Schmidt Ocean Institute and graduate student at the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Tori, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks, Carly. I'm excited to be here. I'm a master's student at the at UH in the marine biology program, as you said, and I'm a lifelong coral nerd. I study coral interactions with seaweed on the reef. So I'm excited to talk more coral today.
Now, we let you pick the topic, and you picked coral reefs. So why did you feel this was an important topic to cover today?
Coral reefs are so important. They directly feed and provide livelihoods for over 1 billion people, harbor 25% of world fish, protect coastlines from storm surges and erosion, contribute to HIV and cancer treatment, and altogether provide an estimated $30 billion a year in goods and services.
Well, I really look forward to hearing more, and I'm going to turn it over to you for some of the interviews today with our three esteemed guests, Dr. Zach Forsman, Dr. Mary Hagedorn, and Dr. Sonia Rowley.
Great. These three guests are really doing cutting-edge coral research, and what's so cool is the different perspectives they're coming from. They're using different methods to help us better understand what coral is, how it lives, and how we can keep it around longer. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Zach Forsman, a research associate at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Thank you for joining me, Zach.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So let's start off by laying a bit of groundwork. What makes coral coral? What makes it unique?
Well, corals are part of a very ancient and diverse group called cnidarians, and they're named this because they have these specialized stinging cells that are kind of like micro harpoons that inject poison. So they're cousins. They're closely related to things like jellyfish and sea anemones. And corals evolved about 200 million years ago. They're basically little colonies of polyps. So think of a jellyfish that's really, really small, that's upside down, that secretes calcium carbonate, which is kind of the same structure as human bone. So they form these structures that really form the foundation, the framework of coral reef ecosystems, which, as you mentioned, are kind of the bedrock, the foundation of a lot of biodiversity in the ocean.
Yeah, and these coral colonies can really look like rock, or they make this kind of skeleton that surrounds them. But like all animals, they do need to grow. So what does that look like for coral?
Well, they grow mostly by budding. So the little individual polyps will kind of divide in half and make new polyps. So they're kind of modular in design. They can kind of reconfigure the way that they grow together. Some of them kind of divide in half in different ways, and they produce all kinds of different forms, like branches or mounding corals, things that look like heads of lettuce in the deeper parts of the ocean. So all kinds of diverse shapes and colors and forms. They're pretty amazing.
I agree. So you've been doing a lot of research on how to actually make coral grow faster. First, why do we need to make coral grow faster?
Well, this kind of got started, I was really interested in cultivating coral kind of as an experimental organism. And because you can divide coral into these small pieces that are genetically identical, that lets you do a lot of interesting experiments where you have a lot of genetic replicates. And so I was really interested in it at more as a model experimental system, and kind of stumbled on this fact that corals, when they're divided really small, will tend to grow really rapidly onto a two-dimensional surface. And colonies or fragments from the same colony will tend to fuse together and cover a large surface in a very rapid amount of time. So this discovery was also noticed by David Vaughn in Moat Marine Laboratory, and he's been using this method to grow some corals that are listed under the Endangered Species Act.
So you are breaking coral into tiny pieces to help it cover more area?
That's right.
That's pretty cool. Is this a practical method to use to restore reef areas where coral might have been killed from bleaching or disease?
I think it's something that has the potential to be practical at a large scale, but it's going to take a lot more work to figure out how to scale up. So right now there are some reef restoration projects like in the Caribbean, for example, in the Seychelles, in the Indian Ocean, that have impacted a pretty large area. They're using a lot of fast-growing corals where you can outplant them fairly rapidly. They're rapidly growing. But for some of the slow-growing corals, this method is one of the best methods that we've found so far. But in order to scale it up, I think one thing that we're looking into is the idea of making lots of little seedlings that we could outplant, because that's the really expensive part of the process is the diver time in the water.
Very cool. Thank you. So switching gears a little bit, your research is also focused on a finer scale, figuring out what makes coral species distinct from each other. But why is that a difficult question when it comes to coral?
Well, it's really, really challenging because the corals come in so many diverse shapes and forms. It's kind of like if an alien came down and tried to describe human beings, they might classify us based on skin color, eye color, even glasses, things like that don't really matter. With the corals, with their variation in shapes and form, we're not really that familiar with them, and the DNA can help kind of make a map of what's closely related, what's distantly related. And then by growing these corals in the lab, you can also get an idea of how flexible or how plastic the growth morphology is.
So you've seen coral change their kind of growth form based on where they are. Can
That's
you describe
correct.
Some of that process?
Yeah, so for example, there's this coral that's commonly called lace coral. So it's very kind of thin and lacy. But under different water motion conditions, it can grow kind of more like a cauliflower coral. So with a combination of the genetic tools and also the cultivating the coral in different aquaria with different water environments, we're really seeing that they can change their form. They can be what's called plastic. And they also have a lot of this phenotypic variability, which means that there's a few genes likely that code for differences, kind of like with human beings and different eye color. We're not different species. We just have a different gene or a few different genes that code for different variation.
So are you seeing that different coral species are more able to change their growth form than others?
Yes. There are some that are extremely variable and others that are not so much. And with the DNA and the cultivation, we're learning kind of which groups are which.
So when you have these corals that have changed the way that they grow, do their offspring grow to resemble that colony, or does it really depend on where it settles?
Oh, that's a really good question. There haven't been a lot of experiments looking at multiple generations because the generation time of coral can be quite long and kind of difficult to kind of close the life cycle loop. But you can do these kind of common garden experiments where you grow things in the same environment and look at whether they grow all similar. Or you can do what's called a reciprocal transplant or genotype by environment study where you move them in the same genotypes in different environments and kind of see if they grow more as a result of their genotype or of the environment.
So are you seeing that these kind of shifts in growth form are creating new coral species? Is that actually, is evolution occurring?
So that's one of the really interesting questions that I'm interested in with the DNA work, is trying to understand how species form and how they evolve in the ocean, because on kind of traditionally it's thought that new species arise because there's something like a mountain range or a barrier that kind of prevents contact and interbreeding. But in the ocean, there aren't these kinds of barriers. And we're finding these really interesting patterns of genetic structure by habitat. So if you look, for example, offshore versus inshore, the corals actually might not interbreed that much, perhaps because they're not adapted to live in these contrasting environments.
It's very interesting. So you might have even the same species of coral in two different environments, but even though they might be reproducing at the same time, they might not cross. They might not interbreed with each other.
That's right. And so it looks like it's the kind of the process of speciation in action. It's genetic structure where they're starting to diverge. These different populations are starting to diverge from each other, which is really fascinating.
That's pretty exciting. Do you have a favorite species of coral?
A favorite species of coral? I'd have to say this purple rice coral. It's called Montipora dilatata. It's a very rare coral, but it's very beautiful. It has these kind of bright purple colors and these little, it almost grows like it has little umbrellas on the top of it. But it's also a very rare coral. There's only about a dozen or so in Kanaohe Bay, and it's not known to occur elsewhere. But genetically, it's kind of lumped in with another species. And we're still trying to understand whether it really is a different species. Should it be protected under the Endangered Species Act? Or is it just a ecotype, a morph? And so that's kind of the challenging type of question that we're trying to answer before these things disappear.
Yeah, that is a complex question. How are you using DNA to figure out relationships like that and with these other species that might be evolving?
Well, it's actually not that easy. The DNA of corals is, there's not really a very good molecular marker, a good gene that works that well. So we've had to resort to collecting more and more and more data. And recently there have been some really big advancements technologically, so we're able to look at thousands of genes instead of just a single or a handful of genes.
So is the picture becoming clearer the more information you add?
Actually, yes, it is in some cases, but in most cases, the patterns are kind of agreeing with what we saw with just a single gene.
Very interesting. Well, have you applied these techniques to other species? Other than coral?
Yeah. So early on in my career, I worked on viruses. I worked on transposons, which are these jumping genes that kind of can move between different organisms. I worked on plants. I worked on insects. I'm working collaboratively on endangered Hawaiian tree snails. So with DNA, you can work on all kinds of different interesting organisms.
But corals are your favorite?
Corals are my favorite because they're the most challenging and the most unusual and most interesting.
Excellent. Well, where is your research going from here?
Well, because we have kind of this flood of data, we have just terabytes and terabytes of DNA sequences. Dealing with all of this data is becoming kind of a question more of computer science instead of just biology. So I've been retraining myself and learning a lot of computer science and learning how to deal with this amount of data. And it's really fascinating and amazing, and that's kind of the direction that I'd like to head in.
That's great. Well, good luck with that. I look forward to hearing more as your research progresses. And thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to go ahead and take a short break, but we're going to talk more corals when we return.
In a minute, I'm going to drown in this pool, surrounded by friends and relatives. That's because Dad thinks Mom is watching me, and Mom thinks Dad is. But actually, nobody is watching me. And you rarely make a sound when you're struggling alone.
Don't assume someone else is watching. Become a water watchdog at abbyshope.org.
Which do you think is riskier for your pet? Scuba diving or squirrel chasing? Twists and turns or fleas and ticks? Turns out everyday dangers make being a pet risky business. But a risk assessment and wellness exam from a veterinarian twice a year can reduce disease risks and prevent problems before they become serious. Contact your veterinarian today because being a pet is risky business. A message from the American Veterinary Medical Association.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, welcoming our special co-host for today, Tori Sindorf, as we learn all about corals. Tori, I'll turn it over to you for the next interview.
Thank you. I'm joined now by Dr. Mary Hagedorn, a research scientist with the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute and affiliate faculty at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. I'm so glad you could join us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tori.
So before we get into your work in cryopreservation, which is freezing coral eggs and embryos and gametes to keep them viable for long periods, let's step back a little bit and talk about coral sex. How do they do it? When do they do it? What does it look like? Paint us a picture.
Okay, great. Coral reproduction. Since coral are animals, everyone should go out of this radio program and understand that corals are animals and they reproduce. But they have the most restricted reproduction on the planet. They only reproduce usually for 2 nights a year, generally, and for 45 minutes each night. So, for example, on the Great Barrier Reef, it's called a massive spawn, and there are over 400 species on that reef, and they are looking for time slots to reproduce in, and it takes about a week for the whole reef to reproduce, but they're all going, each species is going for, you know, in its time slot for 2 sequential nights after the full moon generally.
That's amazing. So every individual in one species will reproduce at the same time?
Often, that is the case. They can't move, so they have to be synchronized. And they have only about 10 cells in their bodies, and they have pigments in their bodies that are very similar to the pigments in our eyes. And so they can look at the sun and the moon, and they monitor temperature, and they synchronize their reproduction to the minute, actually, or very close to it. I mean, I know exactly when the coral are going to spawn in Kaneohe Bay, and we set our schedule for the year based on that knowledge.
Well, it's nice that they're timely.
Very.
So these coral eggs and sperm are floating around in the ocean. How long do they have before they need to find each other before fertilization can happen?
Right. It can vary with the different species, but generally it's probably a couple of hours, 2 to 4 hours perhaps. Ideally it would be within an hour or so, but they don't have a long period of time for the actual fertilization. However, once they become larvae, then they can often drift for months, depending on the species. And Zach was talking about the lace coral. This is a particular species that is called a pioneering species, and they can go for months and often reach, you know, far shores.
That's amazing. So these little swimming larvae can actually just hang out in the water. They have this whole swimming life stage before they settle down and decide to become adult stationary corals.
Absolutely.
Very cool. Because of that, it seems like there would be quite a bit of connectivity between different reef coral populations. Is that true?
Well, this is not my specialty. It's probably better asked with Zach. But as Zach was mentioning, there are inshore and offshore populations. It actually depends on the flow. And so if you have really good currents that connect the various areas, then you will have good connectivity. But there can be areas that are very close to each other, even patch reefs within Kaneohe Bay, that do not interbreed.
Very interesting. So for those of us who don't do it, can you describe what cryopreservation is?
Right. Well, I think many people are familiar in some way because many families go through human-assisted reproduction. And so this is exactly what we do with coral. We set up a coral-assisted reproduction program. And the basic premise is that you need to get some of the water that's inside the cell out and replace it with an antifreeze, just like we do in our cars to prevent our cars on the East Coast, of course, or in some cold weather area from freezing. And the ice crystals inside a cell can damage the cell lethally. And so you want to stop that. And the antifreeze can suppress ice crystals just as they do in your car. And so once we can get this antifreeze in, then we can successfully start to freeze them in a variety of different ways. And they can stay in liquid nitrogen, which is usually minus 196 degrees for theoretically tens or even hundreds of years. So they can stay frozen but alive for at least tens of years. That gives us an opportunity to really use this technique for a variety of ways.
Yeah, that's a long time. I didn't realize it was that long. Mm-hmm. So why is this important? Why do we need to freeze coral eggs and sperm?
We need to be doing a variety of sort of restoration ecosystems assistance. And all the people that are here today are doing those. And we're just one way of doing this. And corals around the world are under siege because of our overuse of fossil fuels, and we are the CO2 or carbon dioxide in our environment is warming and acidifying our oceans, and that's making the oceans somewhat inhospitable to corals because they depend on a very constant environment, and it's stressing them. It can cause disease, and so many areas of the world today are now seeing depletions in our coral populations. And on top of this, we're seeing warming events that are increasing in their frequency. And think of it, a warming event as always being very hot summer, where it's like 110 degrees, and you don't want your baby sister or your grandmother to go out in the sun for a long period of time because they could suffer, you know, overexhaustion or heat stroke. And that's exactly what's happening to some of the corals. They're overheating, they're stressing, and can die.
So is this overheating actually negatively affecting the process of reproduction?
We have seen in the past, we have long-term monitoring of reproduction in Kaneohe Bay, where we're looking at two species. And we've seen a 50% decrease in sperm motility in those two species. We've seen a reduction in egg size. And we're seeing a reduction in overall larval ability to grow and to settle.
So that sounds like yes. Wow.
A short answer, yeah.
Yeah. What are some challenges you face as you've been working to perfect this technique with coral?
So, you know, the biggest challenge is to get onto a reef when they're spawning. So they spawn in lovely areas, but they're very remote. We use a lot of technology, microscopes, and we even use lasers and all. I mean, we're very high tech. And so getting all that gear to a place that has the right current and actually has the electricity when you need it can be very challenging. And being there at the right time, I mean, we got a whole group together. We had 20 people going to Belize 1 year. It was supposed to happen in August, and they spawned a month early because it was warming. So being there at the right time with the right equipment and the right people and having the funding to consistently do this and train people are some of the many challenges that we face in sort of expanding and keeping this going for the oceans around the world.
That's interesting. So some coral are even changing the timing of their reproduction because of this warming.
Yes. If it's warm enough, they will advance a month.
That seems like a challenge. So we talked a little bit about how these coral larvae are swimming on the reef. When you fertilize these test tube coral babies in the lab, how easy is it for you to get them to settle and become adult corals?
It's a really good question. We just actually did have a paper that came out on that. And it's a challenge, actually, because you're going from a very small laboratory setting to a larger scale. You're really thinking of it as aquaculture. And so it actually took us 3 years to do this, and we had multiple failures. We ultimately got the coral to settle, and we did this in Australia on the Great Barrier Reef. And we saw that we had equal settlement between the coral that were made with cryopreserved sperm and the fresh sperm. And we actually brought the sperm from a bank, and some of it was 2 and 3 years old. So we were able to use older sperm as well as freshly cryopreserved sperm, and we got equal settlement for these. So we took the first step in making this a restoration tool.
It's kind of funny to think of a coral sperm bank. But I like that one exists.
It does.
What species are you focusing on with this research?
Well, any that we can get our hands on, quite frankly. We use Hawaii really as our laboratory. The nice thing about Hawaii is it's different than the rest of the world in terms of the coral reproduction here. It reproduces in a much more elongated fashion. So we start in May with certain species, and we can go all the way to September. And some months we'll have 2 and 3 species spawning. So it gives us more time to make mistakes, actually, and to perfect our techniques. When you have 2 nights and you only have 2 hours each night, it's like, well, okay, we'll see you next year and try this again. You know, so we take the information that we have here in Hawaii and we quickly apply it, like to the Great Barrier Reef or to the Caribbean.
That's interesting. So are you mostly freezing gametes separately, or do you try to fertilize things and then store the embryos?
So we are, right now, everything that's banked is sperm, and we have 16 species, many of them from the Great Barrier Reef, that have been frozen, and we have billions of samples. Really, we have a lot of samples. Our genetic diversity, we don't have as much as we would like to say from the northern Great Barrier Reef, where they've suffered the most challenges. But we are now just starting to do coral larvae, and we hope to have a paper out on that soon. We've successfully cryopreserved coral larvae. We can't do eggs yet because we have such a short period of time when we can test the eggs. The eggs only last for 2 hours, and it's very, very hard to do it on an egg. So that's going to be a challenge. But we're also doing a wide variety of other things, fish, urchins. We even cryopreserve the Cymbiodinium inside the coral. So we're trying to think of the reef as more of a ecosystem, although that's very naive. We're not freezing the whole ecosystem, but we're trying to think of it more broadly than just coral itself.
That's great. Your work was featured recently in the short film Saving Coral. That's a pretty exciting piece of publicity. How is your work saving coral?
It isn't saving coral right this minute, although we need to be able to develop the science for the cryo. We're developing all the cryobiology science, so the basic science that makes this work, because we're the only laboratory really in the world that's creating the science and applying it. And so we are also applying it, so we're going out into the field and we're actually collecting the material and banking it. And then trying to make this an actual restoration strategy. And so as we move forward, everything that we do, whether it's sperm or larvae or eggs, our goal is always, how can we make this better? How can we make it a restoration strategy? And one of the ways that we're thinking the next steps that we want to do is to think high throughput. So instead of our boutique way that we're doing it now, which is very small and very limited, we're thinking of millions of larvae at a time, or millions of eggs, because we lose so many. If we want to put 1,000 coral reefs on and have them be adults, we need to start out with millions. And so that's our mindscape when we're thinking about this. We start small, we get it to work, and then we try and expand it.
So are you imagining that this would look like tossing a bunch of coral sperm in the ocean, fertilizing a bunch of eggs and releasing larvae, or actually growing tiny coral that you would then plant on the reef?
It will always be something where we have a nursery aspect to it. If we were just throwing sperm in the water, it would not work. It's very prescribed in how we do it. We count everything. Everything is tested. And so we will work always in a nursery setting, laboratory to nursery. But one of the things I think that is very needed, and I'm sure many of my colleagues here would agree, is that we need better availability and flexibility in our permitting, so that we can outplant more easily. Some of the things that we're doing, if we are in the guidelines within a state or, say, the country of Australia. Australia is very prescribed, and even though we got coral that were cryopreserved to settle, we could not outplant them because of the permitting issue. So that needs to be addressed, I think, more fully in the future, as if they want these kinds of broader restoration techniques that include high tech.
Yeah, it seems like that would be a really good strategy to try and combat some of this coral death after all of the coral bleaching in the Great Barrier Reef.
Right.
So you talked about using this for other species like fish and sea urchins. Is it pretty much the same no matter what species you're working with? Does the technique change?
It does, yes. So all the coral species are the same, at least for the sperm. We're learning about the larvae. The larvae will change because coral have very small and very large larvae. And we're using a method called ultra-rapid worming, where we surround the larvae with gold particles and we freeze it and then we hit it with a laser. And the laser warms it at 10 million degrees per minute or thereabouts. And so we have to tweak those techniques. But basically, it's more or less the same process. And we learn very quickly from one species to quickly adapt it to another.
That's very cool. So the next step with your research, it sounds like you're just trying to make this more applicable to restoration. Is that correct?
Yes. And Zach talked about microfragments. It's one of the areas that we're getting into. We're growing them out now, and we're trying to cryopreserve these microfragments because reproduction is becoming more restricted. We are impacting reproduction by our living here on the planet, and not curbing our CO2 and the warming it's causing in the ocean. And we're restricted in reproduction, and with using these microfragments, we are not restricted to reproduction and can move much faster.
And I had a question for you. We were talking about the film Saving Corals, and filming has really grown with, in terms of coral research lately. We've seen Saving Corals and Chasing Corals and all these different documentaries that have been talking about the concern with coral reefs. How do you think this attention is affecting the research for coral reefs, and does it help you in your mission and what you're doing?
I think it does. You know, when I think of like Save the Whale campaigns that were so broad in the 80s and the 90s, it really had a huge impact on the amount of funds and attention and just people caring about whales. We now have many populations that are now almost back to, you know, sustainability. And we can only hope that this kind of attention that's being focused on this really critical ecosystem, you know, critical in terms of how the ocean functions, but also, you know, how our oceans function. I think it can help. Programs like this, it's really important to engage and to inspire and to educate the public.
I really like the analogy to the whales. I think that's a very good point. And just, you know, being able to visualize, like, you know, not everybody has access to the reefs or sees coral bleaching or even sees a coral spawning. Can you describe what does a coral spawning look like, and that energy's got to be pretty incredible. I mean, you have one or two nights to collect and to observe this event. Can you walk us through what that looks like?
Yeah, it is one of the most cool events on Earth, and it is the only event, biological event, that you can see from space, or the results, because you can see the slick from, you know, some of the satellites on the Great Barrier Reef when they're all spawning at the same time. You can see it from space. So it's the largest animal-made structure on Earth, the Great Barrier Reef, and when they reproduce, it is amazing. And it's really like if you've ever been in a blizzard. So for Hawaiians, this may be hard to imagine, but imagine a blizzard upside down. So it's going from the bottom and going to the top, and there's just there's just material everywhere, specks of light, and there's fish zipping in and out trying to eat, you know, some of these eggs and sperm, and it is electric. The ocean becomes alive, and you can tell if they're going to spawn or not, because if you're down there and you're looking at the coral and nobody else is interested, they're not going to spawn that night. But if you've got a host of other animals that are just ready to go, you know they're going to spawn. It's very electric. It's amazing to watch.
So a once-in-a-lifetime coral orgy, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And it happens here in Kaneohe Bay, so people should go out and watch it.
So that was my next question is, you know, if someone wanted to observe this, how would the public go ahead and do that or get involved with this?
Well, you know, we can give you a schedule for 2018 when corals are going to spawn. And there are events at the Waikiki Aquarium that are sponsored. And if someone's really interested, there's someone who just absolutely has to see this to put their bucket list, you know, they can contact us through HIMB Education Office, and we'll be happy to help them.
Well, I'm definitely putting coral spawning on my bucket list.
Perfect.
For sure. And one of the other things that was really interesting to me that you mentioned was not just, you know, looking at freezing of these coral gametes, but all, you know, looking at it from a whole holistic perspective, the entire ecosystem. Mm. What about some of the smaller pieces or organisms in the ecosystem, like microbes? Is that something that you can freeze, or is it too tiny?
No, they're actually quite easy to freeze. And we did a biodiversity assessment of Kaneohe Bay in May, and there's an amazing group at HIMB and at UH that works on microbes, and they're doing a year-long measurement of Kaneohe Bay in a variety of different areas. And we actually froze some for them and put them in a bank. But I'm sure Zach can expand on this, but the coral itself is a holobiont, and what that means is it's got bacteria, it's got all sorts of things on it. And if we are successful in freezing these microfragments, it'll be the coral, it'll be the algae that live inside of itself, we call symbionts, as well as the microbes on the surface. So it could be a good population to sort of think about in terms of freezing.
And since we asked Zach, we're going to have to ask you this question. What is your favorite coral species to work with?
Okay, I had to ponder that because I like them all. But there's one species in Australia, and it's called a Acropora tenuis. And the reason I like it is because it's easy. And, you know, they spawn reliably. You get billions of egg sperm bundles from them. They fertilize easily. They settle easily. For a biologist to have a coral that is easy, and coral are not easy for anything really, especially in terms of reproduction, that you can really work out your techniques on and get some answers, it's a godsend. So I have a vote for Acropora tenuis.
All right. Well, we're going to have a coral off at the end of this. Well, thank you so much,
You're welcome,
Mary, for being
pleasure.
Here today. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk more corals.
You mean I could have diabetes and not even know it?
Then why would I want to know?
Heart disease, amputations, stroke, blindness can all be caused by diabetes. So it's critical that you know. If you're over 45, you don't exercise, and you're overweight, you're at risk. But a simple blood test can detect the problem, and with early treatment, you can prevent the devastating effects of diabetes. Call the American Diabetes Association at 1-800-DIABETES. Don't be blind to diabetes.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice,
what if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home, should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we are talking about one of my personal favorite subjects, corals. With us today is a special co-host, our science communications intern, Tori Sindorf, who's helping us to learn all about corals. Passing it over to you, Tori.
Thank you, Carly. All right. So to give us a slightly different perspective, I'm joined now by Dr. Sonia Rowley, a postdoctoral research associate at the University of Hawaii, an invertebrate zoologist with the Bishop Museum in Honolulu, chief scientific officer of the Association for Marine Exploration, and recipient of the prestigious Sir David Attenborough Award for Fieldwork, which is awarded by the Systematics and Linnaean Society of London, which, incidentally, you were just inducted into. So welcome and congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you received this award for your work on a different kind of coral than we've been talking about. So these, the diversity and systematics of Gorgonian corals, which are actually a soft coral. Can you tell us a little bit about how they're different from the hard corals we normally see on the reef?
Yes. So Gorgonians are part of a group called Octocorallia, octocorals. So basically the Scleractinians, or the, you know, let's say the hard corals that people are used to seeing on the reefs and what Zach and Mary have been talking about, essentially divided up in six or multiples of six, where octocorals is just eight. Basically, it's very simple. So they have eight tentacles, and they also have pinnate tentacles, so baby tentacles on their tentacles, and that increases their surface area. So that's a very simple way of actually differentiating Gorgonians and their friends and their soft corals to the most commonly associated corals. The other thing is Octocorallia, also a very old group, and they actually constitute about 64% of all the sort of corals that you actually have on the planet across the full depth range.
So they're soft corals. Do they still build their own skeleton, but it looks a little bit different than a hard coral?
Yes. So this is basically Gorgonians actually lack a phylogenetic hypothesis. Basically, they're not straightforward, which makes them quite exciting. And so most Gorgonians, with the exception of a couple of rogue Gorgonians, look like they're arborescent. You would imagine like a tree or a fan. And they have a central axis. And that has components of calcium carbonate and magnesium, and also have something called Gorgonin, which is where they get their name from, Gorgonian. So you also have another group that very related and often intertwined, that are the soft corals proper, and they really rely on hydrostatic pressure, which is water movement, in order to actually keep them upright. So the Gorgonians also, and other soft corals, they have something called sclerites, sponges they're called spicules, and these are small skeletal elements that actually then constitute more structure to their physical appearance.
So when you take a hard coral out of the water, it's basically a rock, right? It's got tissue on the outside, but it's basically a rock. If you take a Gorgonian out of the water, does it flop or does it keep its structure?
They keep their structure.
But a soft coral would flop.
Yeah, totally flop.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
A good distinction.
Excellent.
So these hard corals that we normally see on the reef, they use photosynthesis, really, to feed themselves. They've got symbiotic algae that make sugar for them. Is that the same for Gorgonians? Do they have symbiotic algae too?
Some of them do, yes. In fact, most of my PhD was based on something called Isis hippuris, which is in Indonesia. But it's actually quite widely distributed, but I did a lot of work on there, and that's zooxanthellate. All of the shallow water Gorgonians of the tropical Atlantic, they are zooxanthellate. Most of the Gorgonians of the Indo-Pacific, which is where my research lies, they're actually azooxanthellate, with just a handful of taxa that are actually zooxanthellate in the shallows.
So what are they eating then?
Well, that's one of the things I'm looking at, which is really quite interesting. I believe they're gardening bacteria. They've created for themselves a wider surface area to actually capture dissolved organic matter. And the other thing is they have a very small pharynx. You know, their guts are super, super small. And so from the observations that I've actually made both in the field and in aquaria, is they can't handle large things. If you try to feed them Artemia, what happens if you film them for long enough, they actually start to spit them out. They don't have them. And over a six-week period, I run a short experiment just to see, because everyone's like, oh, yeah, you must feed them this, you know, big zooplankton. And so I did. And they all died. They starved. Which goes to show you that it's not the big stuff that they actually eat. And using some genomic analysis and some transplant experiments, so I've run transplant experiments on the mesophotic Gorgonians that I'm working on, and down from like 130 meters, which is it's around 400 feet, up to 30 meters, which is about 100 feet. And actually, when you start moving them around, and also in aquaria, you have to really go some to actually change their microbial friends. That was very, very interesting. So they really stayed, they bonded, you know, it's like friends for life, very much so. So it's that kind of thing. I believe that you've got reciprocal metabolic pathways. So there's pathways. It's very, very similar to what people are doing with the corals and other systems. Like you've got the bobtail squid here. You've got this intimate relationship between the host, the coral host, and its microbiome.
That's interesting. So you're saying that maybe instead of having the internal symbiotic algae, they might have symbiotic bacteria that are living on them and that they're choosing as associates. So they might also be eating?
Yes, they seem to could be having an obligate relationship. The thing is, it's so new. You know, these are my ideas. You know, people could be like, But the other thing is, I mean, it makes me laugh. I've got, you know, hundreds of hours of filming them in the field and in aquaria, and they've got that. You know, as part of Cnidaria, they have nematocysts, which are stinging cells, which Zach alluded to earlier, spoke about. And the octocorals and the Gorgonians, they are quite useless. They really are useless. They couldn't catch a cold. Honestly, I've never seen anything like it. So it's like, if you have evolved to be such a lousy predator in that respect, then really we need to look deeper into the system and see what's really going on. And the other thing that I'm finding extremely interesting is that actually down in the mesophotic zone, the nutrient and the chlorophyll levels are very high compared to what you would have in the shallows. And this is where you get a high distribution and density and diversity of Gorgonian octocorals. You get fields of them.
That's interesting. I would expect that there would be more nutrients up where there's sunlight. You'd think, you know, phytoplankton use sunlight. They must be up there.
Yeah, quite. It's actually something I'm looking in at the moment around in Micronesia, and it's actually extremely fascinating. I mean, it blew my mind. I was like, oh my goodness, you know, and there's these internal waves and they are island driven. And so that is something that I'm just sort of embarking on right now. It's like, why are you here? Why are you so biologically successful? It's all a matter of scale, from sort of like the ecosystem scale all the way down to the micro scale. So it keeps me off the streets.
Something has to.
Yeah.
How many Gorgonian species are there?
Oh, that's a question. That is sort of, I think it's going to be like a lifelong mission. And so a very prominent scientist at the Smithsonian, actually, Steve Cairns, and he wrote this awesome paper, and which is, he said, so the octocorals are over 3,000 species, and 75% of those actually exist below 50 metres. Now, the taxonomic state of the octocorallia of Gorgonians is really in a complete mess, and taxonomy per se is a very big and fascinating challenge, as you've heard some of this stuff from Zach today, and it's really very, very interesting. The thing is with the deep and the twilight zone in particular is I find a lot of intermediate morphotypes, for want of a better way of putting it, morpho species. And they seem to be bridging the gap between recognized species. It's one of those questions I could go on for a long time, and I'm sure you need to sleep tonight. And however, I really don't know, but I know they're immensely speciosed. And in the lab up in UH, I have over 7,000 specimens now. And I can't tell you how many morpho species there are there. But I have to be very cautious when I try and publish, because, people are like, no, you can't possibly have seen that many. And I'm like, so I have to be very cautious. So it's very much, it's a work in progress, just as much as with Scleractinia and many other taxonomic groups.
So it sounds like, just like Zach, you're seeing a lot of coral that might not be completely genetically distinct, but look completely different. Is that true?
Yes. So the work that I did on a zooxanthellate gorgonian in Indonesia, I actually did reciprocal transplant experiments. That paper will be coming out at the end of the year, thank goodness. And so using morphology and genetics, what was seemed to be happening is you've got a level of incipiency, the onset of species then turning into new species as a consequence of being in a different environment. And that environment was actually a very degraded system through human impact.
So you're seeing these things at kind of a confusing intermediate point where they're not distinct species yet, but you think they might become that.
Yes, they seem to be definitely moving in that direction. And interestingly, at one time, they're external brooders, this particular species. And just the ones at the impacted site started spawning 1 year. And none of them from any of the other sites, nothing, just nothing. And that one site had 1 to 2 degrees mean temperature average increase. And I was deeply fascinated, because that is on my bucket list. I really, coral spawning, absolutely. I'm deeply fascinated. I don't mind on the species, not fussy, just want to see it.
Sounds like we'll all be congregating at HIND this summer to see some. So you mostly focus on the deeper sea, this twilight zone that you talked about. How do things look different down there versus the shallow reefs that we normally see?
Well, on the whole, they're all deeply fascinating, irrespective of depth. That's a very, very good question that I'm actually struggling to answer. When I get down there, it's overwhelming. It is absolutely overwhelming. I think Mary kind of epitomized you're just deeply fascinated and you don't know where to begin, and it's just amazing, and you've got this very short period of time. There's fields of different animals, different gorgonians, and this haven of fish and invertebrate taxa. Just, the fish are swimming within all the branches. There's lots of juveniles, lots of very small specialists on certain species. There's so much information. It's just fascinating. And there's animals that I see in the shallows and I see in the very, very deep, using ROV and submarines. And when I'm actually in that middle section, for want of a better way of putting it, it's like they are intermediates. And it's like, right, really want to find out how you are related to so-and-so and the mechanisms of evolution to why you look that way and why you are here.
That is interesting. So there might be a gradient from shallow water species to the very deep where things are changing all the way down.
There's quite a distinction. There's some very interesting research that has been conducted in the tropical Atlantic and how they're showing. And I was terribly excited. I was partly excited and partly down because I hadn't managed to get around to doing it myself. But from the morphology, from what I'm seeing, it completely agrees, is that the shallow water and the deeper species in the lower mesophotic, so to speak, are actually not related. And the deeper ones are related to the much deeper taxa, which is exactly what I see. Absolutely. I mean, it's like you draw a line. There's just specific taxa at depth compared to the ones that are much more related to the shallows. And then you've got, of course, you've got this attenuation that goes eastward from the Indo-Pacific, which makes Hawaii and also this whole region, the Indo-Pacific, deeply fascinating, because then you're able to look at how these things have evolved over geological time because of the activity that's happened.
Very interesting. Have you found any new species yet?
Yes.
Do you get to name them?
Yes, I do.
Do you name them after yourself?
No. No, I don't. That would just be weird.
Do you try to find creative names, or do you try to be more serious with it?
I'm at the moment, I'm more sort of quite overwhelmed by them. But there's some of them that I'm very, you know, there's some that you're just very, very specific in that you just know, right, I'm going to use this relative to the native language, you know, that kind of stuff. So I try to put it back to the communities of where I have found those animals. Because actually I've found that, so I share all my information, all my data, all my imagery and all the rest of it with the local communities where I research. And I've actually found that, much to my surprise, that it helps them in defining their marine protected areas. And so that then helps, they invite me back, which is great. So it's a win-win situation. I had not anticipated it. So to honour them is I try to use the local community languages and historical cultural side of things.
That seems like a very reasonable way to go. Better than a whole suite of Sonia corals.
Oh, goodness. No, I think it's quite illegal, is it? No, I just, oh my God, oh no.
Well, your research is so exciting. Where is it taking you next?
It depends where I can get the funding. That's the truth. I would like to continue. I would very much like to do more genomic work on my research. I'm moving around these animals. I'm privileged to have this opportunity and skill. I was raised as a diver. I was raised on diving boats. I was a commercial diver before I decided to be a scientist. Now I want to ask and now seriously address the mechanisms of evolution of why these animals look this way and why they're here and why some are not there. And I'm also deeply fascinated in their relationship, you know, the coral holobiont. There is a wide open door, really. There really is a wide open door to how these animals are so biologically successful over geological time.
And since we asked everyone else, do you have a favorite coral?
It's so unfair. It's so unfair. I have quite a few. I know that's probably illegal, but I suppose Anella. I've done a lot of work on Anella, and I understand it means angel in Hawaii.
Oh,
yeah, and
nice.
It's yeah, and I just, they are really fascinating, and they bounce back even though I chop them up and put them in all sorts of places, and you get pygmy seahorses on them, and you know they're pink. What more could you want?
That sounds like a nice little coral, pink little angel. Yeah. Do you have any final words for us before we sign off?
Well. Thank you very, very much for having us today. I hope it's made people realize that there's much more to Cnidaria than just what you see in the shallows, but how everything is terribly, terribly linked and that we really need to take care of it.
Thank you.
Well, I would like to thank all of our guests today for coming on and speaking so candidly and bringing some really interesting insights into the world of corals. I'd also like to thank our special co-host today, Tori. You did a fantastic job. Thank you so much for being here. And a special thank you to our sponsors, the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.